Kate Green is a laser physicist and an author, but growing up, Kate was a Lego kid.
I had a lot of space Lego sets and hand-me-downs from my older brothers, and I just loved living in that world.
From the farthest reaches of imagination comes a Lego space set with all kinds of pieces to build all kinds of spacecraft, like this.
Now a writer of poetry and nonfiction, Kate's love of play and exploration created in her this huge aspiration to be an astronaut, to go to space. So why didn't she become an astronaut?
Oh, probably just one or two reasons.
It kind of goes without saying, but becoming an astronaut is not only very hard, but pretty unlikely. For Kate, going to space just wasn't in the stars. But there was another way to scratch that extraterrestrial itch. In 2011, Kate read an article about what astronauts eat in space. But the piece wasn't just about their diets. There was a call to action.
The scientists who were interviewed for this article were looking for participants to study this question of space food and how to make sure that astronauts on a Mars mission might eat enough food so that they can stay healthy. And I couldn't believe it. You know, as I was reading this article, I got more and more excited because I just thought this is such a strange topic of space research that I had no idea existed. And then at the end, there was a link to apply to be a possible participant in this NASA study. And I thought, oh, okay.
It was meant to simulate living in space, specifically living on Mars or the moon, these inhospitable lands that will devastate humans if they aren't prepared. After several interviews and tests and meetings with NASA scientists and other potential test subjects, Kate was accepted. She packed a few things and went, not to space, but to a bubble on the slopes of a Hawaiian volcano. The space itch would be scratched. But what she didn't anticipate were the ethical questions she'd have to wrestle with while participating in the study.
We could go outside, but only wearing these simulated spacesuits. So we were not getting a lot of sunlight or any sunlight at all, let alone any sort of like outdoor time, you know, in great quantities. So there was like this the airlock section was outside like the main dome space. And there was just a single layer of vinyl there. So the sun came through really brightly there. And I took one of the puffy chairs and I just set it right in this beam of sun and was working on my laptop. And I just felt like so warmed.
A decade after her stint on Mars, Hawaii, NASA still doesn't seem to be reconciling those issues, and they're doing the same tests today. This Tuesday is the last day to apply for the second round of a NASA experiment known as CHIPEA. That stands for Crew Health and Performance Exploration Analog. Hundreds of applicants are vying for the chance to spend a year living just like Kate did, with no sun, no plants, bad food, and the same four people day in and day out in a 1,700 square foot space. Today on the show, NASA knows how to get to space, but what happens when you're there? I'm Shayna Roth, filling in for Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about tech, power, and how the future will be determined. Stick around. Reporter Nathaniel Rich wanted to know more about these Mars simulations, so he profiled participants in the first series of CHIPEA isolation experiments for the New York Times.
CHIPEA is the latest in a very long series of isolation studies and Mars analog experiments conducted by NASA, all of which lock people in a room or chamber of some kind for a long period of time to see how they will handle psychologically confined isolation in preparation for what is believed to be the future of the space program, which is human exploration and habitation of Mars and other planets and the moon, and ultimately colonies on other planets.
The setup of the experiments mostly hasn't changed since the one Kate participated in 10 years ago. I mean, they won't be on the side of a volcano this time, but the test subjects will be locked in a building for a whole year rather than the 4 months Kate was inside.
It's a 1,700 square foot structure built with a state-of-the-art 3D printer, which is how all structures are expected to be built on Mars in the future. It builds up line by line until you get the 1,700 square foot habitat, which has 4 bedrooms, some common areas. There are no windows. And next to, there is one portal that goes out to a yard, basically, that's a sandbox filled with red sand where the experimenters go on walks on treadmills. But the entire thing is a structure built within the Johnson Space Center. So it's inside of a warehouse. There's a 22-minute delay in communication and in the streaming videos and all the rest to simulate the delay there would be to communicate with people on Mars.
Kate didn't stay in a warehouse, but she did stay in a bubble 8,200 feet above sea level. Kate says she also dealt with an on-purpose delay in communications, and she had to eat specific meals so NASA could study their effect on astronauts' health.
It was about the challenges of keeping astronauts' diets healthy, making sure that they're taking in enough calories while they're on long-haul space missions. And so there are some theories nobody really knew. Did they get bored with food? Was it like fluid shift in their body? But what they did know was that astronauts were taking in fewer calories, and that could be a really big problem on like a 3-year-long Mars mission because it makes you more susceptible to injury and illness and something that could be catastrophic for an entire mission.
She says the days got really old, really fast.
The monotony of the schedule, like the monotony of this interior space, which we could change around somewhat. The furniture was inflatable. That was on purpose so that you could like redo the space if you wanted to. But kind of the monotony of the conversations you were having, like, did I already have this conversation with you? Or are we repeating ourselves? You know, the monotony of the food, even though we were able to create novel meals there, you know, the texture of the rehydrated vegetables, for instance, never changed. You never got a different cut of carrot, you know.
Here's Nathaniel again.
It's billed as a kind of psychological experiment to see how people do in isolation, eating a, you know, an astronaut diet and being run through a bunch of very highly regimented activities. And also, I should say, subjected to stress. I mean, besides the stress of just the whole thing, they promise to subject the participants to difficult situations, problems will occur. They won't say what they are.
Nathaniel says NASA is tight-lipped about exactly what stressful situations they're putting these participants through. The official line is it wants to know how participants will respond when faced with emergency scenarios. But when you ask NASA just why it's running these tests, you get a different answer, depending on who you talk to.
I spoke with a woman named Rachel McCauley, who's actually the person within the hierarchy who funded the experiment. So she's like the boss. She's not the head experimenter. She's not on the ground monitoring the people in the habitat. She's the person who you know, signed the checks to make sure that it happened. And her interest was altogether different. In fact, this is one of the most shocking moments for me of the reporting. Was when I asked her, you know, well, what are you trying to learn about, you know, psychologically of these people? Like, don't we sort of know what happens when people get isolated and live in confinement for a long period of time? And she said, you know, I'm not really concerned about that. That's not really what I'm interested in. And I said, oh, well, what are you interested in? I thought that was the whole experiment. She said, I need to know how much food they eat. And I said, what do you mean you have much food? She said, yeah, I'm a propulsions engineer. My job is to figure out what kind of, you know, essentially rocket technology needs to be used to propel people to Mars and bring them back. And so I need to know how many pounds we're talking about. I was really flummoxed for a minute, but it turns out that at least the person who's writing the checks, the person in charge of the experiment, could seemingly care less about the
psychological aspect, and she just wants to know how much food they're going to eat over time so that she knows which rocket ship to use.
Here's the thing. Obviously, NASA would be concerned about how much fuel they'd need for an extended mission. The margins of error in space are so small, and there are millions of things about them that a non-space expert would never even consider. But while testing and isolation experiments can answer those kinds of thorny questions, Nathaniel wonders, are they worth the cost?
There's this series of studies that I write about from the 50s. When there was a huge amount of isolation research within NASA and within NASA's predecessor, within the Air Force, in which they lock people away in rooms and people go crazy. There's a whole like tradition in science fiction, you know, space horror, essentially. Astronauts off in space drifting away from Earth or drifting away from their vessel, losing their mind. So on a tactical level, one wonders, well, what is NASA doing? Like, don't they know the answers? So why are they spending some of their money on this? What are they trying to prove? Is this a form of advertising for the space program, you know, to get sort of do some PR to get more funding? Because they're constantly, you know, as well funded as they might be, they are always, you know, feel that they are deeply underfunded. And, you know, they might be, it's hard for me to evaluate that conversation, but are we trying to prepare ourselves for something that we feel is coming on some level?
When we come back, what do these tests say about the way we view space travel and how we prepare ourselves for it? The first round of Chepia Mars simulations began last year. 4 people were selected to participate, but nearly 4,000 people applied. It's easy to see why. For some, space is full of magic and wonder, a mysterious void, a cosmic question mark. My daughter turns 4 this month, and already she's in love.
What do you like about space?
I like to go up into space because I want to go on the Earth. I mean, I want to go on some planets to see how they look like.
Well, that's very interesting. Would you like to be an astronaut someday?
Yes.
Why would you like to be an astronaut?
It is cool to be an astronaut.
As a kid, I wanted to be an astronaut. And I spent a lot of time imagining myself in astronaut scenarios.
This is Kate Green again, the one who participated in a Mars simulation experiment 10 years ago. She knows firsthand why you'd want to do this.
And in a lot of those scenarios, it was like a single astronaut situation. I don't know what kind of sci-fi stories or shows or movies kind of led me to that. But I really did, as a kid, imagine myself as a sort of like solo explorer. Very unrealistic. That's not how exploration works. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I kind of like idealized some sort of like self-reliance stuff too. So I thought, you know, this sounds like a really interesting challenge because I think I'm a kind of person who's curious about who I am in different environments, you know, like what about me is stable and what about me is a little bit more malleable. And so the thought of being in such an extreme environment, I think, intrigued me for potentially what it would reveal about myself.
As long as there are people like Kate asking these questions, dreaming of space, NASA will have hundreds of willing participants for these Mars programs. But Nathaniel Rich says it's unclear how long it will keep doing them or when it will actually send people to the real Mars.
And I mean, I asked that a few times because what's going on here within NASA is the high majority of their efforts and their funding and their personnel are focused on technological, scientific questions, you know. Rachel McCauley told me she had a punch list of 800 problems that she needs to solve before launch. And those tend to have to do with, you know, what's the best kind of bolt to use? What's the best airlock? You know, what's the best fuel? What's, you know, all of that. And they're 100% confident they'll solve all those problems. It's just a matter of time In the past, they said we will be on Mars by the end of the 2020s. They're now saying it's more like the end of the 2030s is the current estimate. 2035 to 2040 is my sense. But that it'll happen, they have no doubt. And that's in documents published by NASA.
Nathaniel says, even if these experiments continue, it's unclear to him how useful they are. I mean, how much can you extrapolate based on the behavior of just four people?
You know, one ethicist said, you'd have to run this experiment, 1,000 times or something for the results to be statistically significant to the extent where it can inform choices that you would make about which people to select and how to prepare them and all of that. But, you know, another ethicist said, well, it's better than nothing. And so we're basically going to do as many of these as we can before launch. But it does seem clear that the technological side of the expeditions of the mission, of the broader Mars mission, is way ahead of the human side of the research.
Like Kate and my daughter, Nathaniel is also a fan of space and the stories about it. But to him, there's a sadness to how we think about these missions.
You know, I was just struck by the kind of lugubriousness of the whole thing. And there's a melancholy quality to, I think, our dreams of space travel, right? That is represented in the science fiction, but also feels represented in this experiment. That seemed consistent with the kind of sadness of isolation and loneliness. And I was trying to understand, you know, what is this undertow that I'm feeling about this? And I kept asking versions of that question to different ethicists. The answer that really crystallized it for me came from a historian of isolation at Cornell. He said to me, you know, this is not about, these experiments are not about going to Mars. They're about losing Earth on some level. And so that kind of made sense to me. It actually gives the clearest rationale for why we're doing this. It's almost like we're trying to create a utopian situation. You know, if we can get these Martian experiments just right, maybe the next time we start all over again, we won't make any mistakes again.
During Kate's 4 months in the simulation, she felt this tension. Over time, she came to view Earth, which she was still on, in a very different way.
I think people who are drawn to like exploration, discovery, expeditions, or even the thought of like living on another planet or, you know, living in space, becoming an astronaut, going to Mars. I think that there is a sense, at least some kind of sense for some of those people, of unbelonging. That's why it appeals. Like NASA basically gave us permission to imagine this extreme non-belonging. We were no longer on Earth. A real distance did arise, you know, like when you saw the news, it was, you know, the people on Earth were experiencing this, you know, it was, oh, wow, like, look at what's so hard, you know, why is it so hard? Like a lot of things become kind of unbelievable that this is what Earth is. And then, you know, you're away and you realize you need to come back. And you're just like, what is this place I'm returning to? For me, that isolation did give me a sense of distance and was it kind of exacerbated a non-belonging. And then the return was pretty extreme, you know, like, no, you actually do belong. And isn't this place great? And actually, why wouldn't you want to live here? This is paradise.
Nathaniel, would you ever want to go to Mars?
No.
Me neither. Honestly, me neither. Honestly, everything could be on fire. I would not get into the rocket. You could not.
I mean, you know, it's a pretty bad place to live, Mars. It's poisonous. It's really hot and really cold. And it's, you know, everything, every physical aspect of it is conspiring to suffocate you and murder you in some way or another. So it's, you have to really want it, I think, to take the risk.
And Kate?
I would not. I don't need to. I've done one. It's good enough.
Nathaniel Rich, Kate Green, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's good talking to you.
Thank you.
Nathaniel Rich writes for the New York Times. Kate Green is an author and poet. And that's our show for today. What Next TBD is produced by Patrick Fort, Evan Campbell, and Anna Phillips. Our show is edited by Paige Osborne. Alicia Montgomery is vice president of audio for Slate. TBD is part of the larger What Next family. If you're a fan of the show, I have a request for you. Please become a Slate Plus member. Just head on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. We'll be back next week with more episodes. I'm Shayna Roth, filling in for Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.
When do you think you'll go to space?
When I'm 10.